Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, December 17th, 2018, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Guys, this is the last episode of the year, just of the year. Don't worry, I'm coming back. I keep on coming back. Yeah, I take a two-week hiatus every year around the holidays, if you remember. So we are going to shut down Talk Nerdy production and pick it back up on January 7th. So no episode on the 24th or the 31st. You're going to be partying, hanging with your family. You won't be listening anyway. We'll have a brand new episode on Monday, January 7th, 2019. But for today, we have a great conversation in store for you. But before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each week. I said that weird. Possible. Yep. And first, I'm going to list my top patrons on Patreon. Remember, you can support the show yourself if you visit patreon.com/talknerdy. I am so appreciative of all of you who do so. I have so many patrons that give like 50 cents an episode, a dollar an episode, a ton that give $5 an episode. You guys don't understand what a massive difference it makes. It's just, I mean, you're the reason that we're here. But at the tippy toppest of supporters, I do want to thank Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T. Bear, the Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much for your tireless support of the show. Many of you have been with me from the very beginning. You have contributed a lot to this show, and I and all of the listeners really do thank you from, you know, the absolute bottom of my heart. If you want to give back to the show in other ways, you can rate and review on iTunes, on Google Podcasts, on Stitcher, you know, share the love on social media, tell your friends and family about it. And you can also go to talknerdymerch.com. That's talknerdymerch.com. That's my online store. Got lots of cool stuff there. They make really, really good holiday gifts, everything from t-shirts to tank tops to hoodies to beanies. The beanies are embroidered. They're really cute. And hats and mugs and signed copies of the Skeptic's Guide book and the National Geographic 2019 Almanac that I'll make out just to you. Lots of cool stuff there. Go ahead and visit talknerdymerch.com. There's probably still a little bit of time to get it in for the holidays. If you want extra special fast shipping, just shoot me an email, shoptalknerdy@gmail.com, and we can arrange it. All right, guys, that's enough business. Let's get to the meat. Okay, this week I had the incredible opportunity to sit down in studio. I love in studio episodes, don't you? And this one was especially good. I got to chat with Shaw Selby. He is a National Geographic Society fellow, you know, an explorer, if you will, for the National Geographic Society. He is also an engineer and conservation technologist. What is that? Well, we're going to talk about it. But the long and short of it is that he works with communities, NGOs, and developing countries to identify and deploy technologies that can really help, that can solve or improve these conservation challenges. He actually founded a conservation technology makerspace and prototyping lab called Conservify, which is here in downtown Los Angeles. They use open source technology to empower local communities to, you know, change the future of the planet. We're going to talk all about his really cool projects and what he has going on. But one thing I want to mention as well is the open source hardware and science hardware, but also open source science platform that he's developing called FieldKit. So if you're interested in FieldKit, go to fieldkit.org to learn more about it. Oh yeah, also he was a rocket scientist before he went into this. So come on, we're going to get into all of that. Sorry, it was a little bit of a long intro, but I just find his bio so fascinating. So guys, without any further ado, here he is, Shaw Selby. Well, Shaw, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
All right. So we are doing a recording in person, which I can't remember the last time I did one. It's been a while, but I always prefer to do the podcast this way because I don't know. I feel like something's a little bit missing when we do it on like online.
Yeah, no, it's nice. It's nice to be face to face.
Yeah. I mean, we're like mostly face to face. There is like half a microphone in front of me, but I can kind of see through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually looking right now. So I think, the last time was with Christina Costantini and Darren Foster, who are the directors and creators of the Nat Geo documentary Science Fair.
Oh, cool.
They actually came in and they shared a mic, so it was a little weird, but you get your own mic.
Nice.
Speaking of Nat Geo, you are a Nat Geo explorer?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so I know there's like weird labels and categories and I've never fully understood it. What is a Nat Geo explorer?
Yeah, so a Nat Geo explorer is, it's evolving now to what it actually means. So now I know National Geographic's trying to grow their explorer family, and that includes giving grants to people that they didn't give grants to before, and reaching out to different parts of the globe that they didn't necessarily fund before. When I joined in, I came in under the Emerging Explorer Program, and so basically the way that worked is it's some kind of nomination process, and the folks at Nat Geo pick around 15 people that they think are doing interesting work in the world that might like turn into something bigger, early career people.
Gotcha.
Typically. And so they do all this vetting, and you're just sitting around one day and you get an email saying you're a Nat Geo explorer. And it's totally by surprise. A lot of people, they feel weird about it and they delete it because they think it's spam or something like that. So that happened to me in 2013. And
did you delete it because you thought it was
No, to be honest, I didn't know what a Nat Geo explorer was. Like, I knew what Nat Geo was. I knew there were explorers, but I didn't know there was a program.
Yeah, I think
when
that's
I got it.
What most people, most people have heard the term explore. They know Nat Geo. They know that Nat Geo, like, doesn't just do TV or magazines. They know they are somehow community-based, but I think the kind of structure and function is a little bit opaque. Not because of anything Nat Geo does, just because it doesn't come across most people's desks.
Totally, yeah. I mean, if you're not looking for research grants or things like that, then you'd never really know about it. And coming from the world of engineering, I wasn't really in that space. So I got the Emerging Explorer in 2013 and then did a bunch of really cool projects with them in the year since. And in 2016, I became a fellow there.
A fellow. Yeah. Okay.
So that's kind of supposed to be the next level up.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so I know a few people that are Nat Geo explorers. I met a lot of explorers this year, last year. It'd be this year because it's December now that we're recording this. It's going to come out in January. So this year at the Nat Geo Explorer Festival.
Right, which I saw you at.
Yeah, I did some hosting on stage. But of course, you were there because you are a Nat Geo Explorer. And we were there to celebrate you and other people who are in that position. And it's always confused me since I first got hired to work as a correspondent on the television show Explorer. Because people would be like, you're a Nat Geo Explorer. And I'm like, no, I'm a correspondent on the show Explorer.
Right.
But Nat Geo Explorers do active science, exploration, discovery, like it's part of your job. And they are helping to fund it. They're helping to collaborate with you, to bring you resources, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So the explorers are, they end up being researchers or academics or citizen scientists, activists, and people who work for NGOs, folks like that are doing something interesting. And previously, Nat Geo has grant programs that you can apply to, but they also kind of seek out these interesting projects and fund those projects. And so the great thing about that festival that you went to is like everybody that you see there is doing some incredible, amazing work, and it just runs the entire gamut. There's, artists there, engineers like me, there's anthropologists and archaeologists and conservationists, it's everything, and it's really, really amazing.
It's almost an embarrassment of riches to the extent that like you're in it all day, every day for the weekend. I'm up on stage introducing explorer after explorer. It's like, okay, this person's doing really cool shit. Okay, this person's doing, and almost it's hard to even realize how amazing it is when everybody's back to back to back.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas within, your own community or, within, let's say, an issue of the magazine or an episode of the show where one of you is featured, it's like, holy crap, look at this incredible life-changing work that you're doing. And then you see, oh my God, there's like literally hundreds of people who are doing incredible life-changing work.
Right. And it's some stuff that you'll talk to be, so you'll just be sitting there at lunch or something, sitting across the table from someone that you've never met, and you're talking to them, and they tell you about the work they're doing, it just blows your mind. It's things that you never even knew existed, right? Yeah. And it's such an incredible thing. And that week is like my favorite week of the year.
It was so much fun.
You know, not only for the conference part, but at the bars late at night, you know, you just end up hearing these stories from the field, and it's just all this wild stuff about people going to some of the most incredible parts of this planet and doing some really phenomenal work.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You mentioned that there really is an expanding of what it means to be an explorer within the Nat Geo ethos lately, that it's about embedded explorers, but it's also about, you know, and that's sort of been the historical, almost, I would say, colonial view of the society, which they did a really good job. They had a recent issue of the magazine where they were like, you know, in the past we fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, this was how exploration used to be done, and it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
And we've learned from our mistakes. So now many explorers are indigenous, or at least, you know, individuals who grew up within the culture, the society of the place where that research is being done.
Totally. They're going the right way right mm-hmm. now in terms of diversity and reaching out to right people. And you know, Asha DeVos is a good friend of mine. She's also a Nat Geo explorer.
She's badass. She just won some big award for Sri Lanka.
Yeah, she's like
Sri Lankan of the year.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing. But she is really kind of helping them to think a lot about that, because one of her pet peeves is this whole parachute science thing, where you have like these really wealthy universities here in the US or in Europe that go into these parts of the world and they gather all this data and then they just leave, you know, mm-hmm. and they don't really engage the scientists in the area, the people who live in that region, the communities. And Nat Geo is really, I think they're really working very hard to try and start to, you know, help those people in those communities, help local scientists get the resources that they need and make the discoveries in their own backyard, as opposed to just relying on kind of Americans to fly over places, that colonial method that they used to do a lot of in their early days.
Yeah, it's mirrored too, I think, across a lot of other approaches. Like, you're seeing it more and more with NGOs, you're seeing it with microloans, you're seeing it with, you know, this historic view that actually, in a way, has all sorts of negative ramifications. Like you said, basically, indigenous knowledge, information is taken away from communities, mm-hmm. and sometimes artifacts, like actual tangible objects, are taken away from communities where they exist, where they belong. You also see this historical problem with NGOs of kind of coming in, providing funding, provide, but not actually integrating this into society. So then there's this, what did they call it? I think a culture of like, oh, I can't remember what the word is, but basically it creates an economy where the individuals require that infusion of cash from other societies, which is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You know? And so we're seeing those changes a lot, where it's like partnering with individuals who are already doing the work.
Totally. Yeah.
We like ignore that. Like, oh, we'll come in and do science in this place where science has never been done. And right. It's like, no, there's a lot of scientists work here.
Yeah. And, you know, we're working with a lot of organizations right now at Conservify about doing that sort of stuff as well. And there's a lot of really, really great work. I think the citizen science movement had a lot to do with it, because we started to kind of think about science outside of these old ivory tower institutions and stuff like that. But yeah, there's a lot of really good movement in the entire science space towards that work.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of this comes down to a change to, oh, I always mix these two up, from an emic to an etic perspective, or am I saying that backward? From etic to an emic. I'm looking it up, etic versus emic. This is a big thing we talk about in psychology. So yeah, an emic perspective is from within the social group, and etic is from outside. So yeah, it's been a big change from an etic perspective into a more emic perspective. But it's also a lot of this due to sort of the democratization, improvements in technology that make them cheaper, mm-hmm. faster, better, easier, more mobile, all that good stuff. And that's a big part of the world that you work in. So you mentioned Conservify.
Correct.
That's your company? Would you call it a company?
Yeah, it's a nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
Yeah, so Conservify is something that I started back in late 2015, early 2016, and actually National Geographic supported the start of that organization. And what it's structured as is a nonprofit open source technology development lab. So the kind of tech development labs you'd see in Silicon Valley that are working around creating, you know, consumer products or things like that, we have a similar facility full of all sorts of prototyping equipment and like 3D printers and laser cutters, and we can make circuit boards and all sorts of stuff. But our main focus is around how we can create those low-cost, better tools for conservation and field science. And so that's the whole focus of what we do is we work with nonprofits, academics, governments, you know, specific scientists to create these tools. And we'll spend some time developing them in the lab, testing them. They're typically grant-funded. And then once we go and deploy them, we make sure everything works. We just open source everything so anyone can do it. And getting back to what we were saying before about working in some of these communities, we actually make a big effort to try and take that knowledge about that technology and work side by side with the community so that not only it's a tool that they're using to gather data, but they actually have ownership over every part of that and what that means. And they can start businesses from it, or they can modify it in their own way. It's all open source. So, you know, we don't care what happens when it leaves. So.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, it sounds to me kind of like a makerspace.
It is. Yeah. It's kind of like a more professional makerspace.
Yeah.
So, it's not open to, I mean, we're happy to collaborate with anyone, and we have all sorts of people come in and work on using our kind of equipment, but
people don't like buy memberships.
No. Yeah. It's, I mean, we have specific projects that we're working on with NGOs or other organizations. And so most of the time on that hardware is just spent in creating that stuff. And
that's so cool. And so is the focus, I mean, obviously it's there are multiple foci depending on like what the project is, but is the idea here like rapid prototyping? Is that a big part of it?
Yeah, that is a part. That's the first part of it, right? Is so if we have some crazy idea or we see some technology that's evolving in a certain way and we know of a conservation problem that we can solve with it, then we'll go through a rapid prototyping effort in the lab. So spend a couple of days hacking something together, write some code for it and build some hardware and see if it works. If it does work, then, you know, we either go into some testing out in the field or we go and chase down some grant money with our partner to try and get that built and implemented. And then we'll go through and deploy it. And we deploy tech like all over the world in some pretty amazing places. And so the whole idea is, you know, we've seen this massive, crazy innovation in tech happen in you know, just in the last 10 years, right? Since pretty much the iPhone came out.
It
has huge implications on everything that we use on a daily basis. And it's really caused sensors and computing devices and all sorts of stuff become really cheap. And we're just leveraging all of that to try and gather data in ways that we've never gathered it before, or protect areas, environmental areas, by stopping poaching or monitoring it in a way that it hasn't been monitored before. And so it's really the exciting thing about our projects is it's just this massive variety of things. I mean,
I love that. And obviously those things can ultimately be adapted in ways that like you might not have even known were possible once they enter into these different communities.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we they're used for many things as well, right? So we'll create some sensors that are actually to monitor a certain area for certain scientific parameters, but find that the community that we're working in is actually using it for environmental justice work. And they're taking the data and they're actually proving that they, you know, there's been an oil spill that's happened or something like that. And that's not something that we designed it to do specifically, but it's that data has more life to it than actually just the science that we're going in to do.
I love that. So we are going to probably spend like the majority of this chat talking about Conservify, talking about some of the really cool projects that have been going on, you know, what the future holds. But I noticed you mentioned you started the company in 2015. You became a Nat Geo Explorer in 2013. Obviously, prior to having this company, this has been the work that you've been doing. And so I'm wondering a little bit about, you know, your background, your training. And I mean, conservation technology is a phrase that I don't even think most people have heard of before.
No, it's pretty new. There's a small group of us, and I you know, I think we're the first people to ever kind of use it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, let me back up a little bit. Conservation technology, that when we use that term, we mean it very specifically. So tech has always been used in science and conservation in some capacity. You know, we use ships to travel to new parts of the world. There's expensive sensors that are used to track animals and things like that. But, you know, all this tech kind of didn't really... It wasn't really designed in a way that leveraged all that new innovation and stuff that we've been doing. It was like maybe tech that's being used for a conservation project was some grad student's project that, you know, a bunch of people started using. They started a company and it was never really optimized in the way.
Yeah. And sometimes it seems like it comes, I mean, the standard in science, at least, is that technology is born out of necessity. So I want to answer a really interesting question and like, oh crap, I don't have a machine that will help me answer it. So I got to just come up with one real quick, kind of glue it together. And then it's good enough to get my project done.
Totally. Yeah. And we're not in that space anymore from a tech, right?
Yeah.
From a tech standpoint, we're in a place where we can go in with a specific design mindset and create something from scratch in like a ridiculously short amount of time. I mean, We spend a week or two kind of building these new ideas and then go out and test them in the world. And that's just something that wasn't possible before, right?
Yeah.
So, conservation technology is kind of this new thing. When I first started calling myself a conservation technologist, it wasn't, you know, I hadn't really heard anyone else calling themselves that. And so this was back in... What happened was I went back to grad school, and it was back in grad school where I started to see this. But my background originally was I was an engineer. I went to school for engineering. I got an amazing engineering job right out of college where I was working on satellites, on the propulsion systems in satellites.
Oh, so more like, I guess that's not really aeronautical engineering, but like...
It's aerospace.
It is aerospace.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Cool,
so
cool.
So I worked in Boeing in El Segundo,
mm-hmm.
and we did, you know, NASA satellites and communication satellites and all sorts of stuff like that.
Did you grow up here?
All around California. Yeah. Moved around a lot.
Yeah. So. But California is home
for
you. Yeah.
No, I'm 100% Californian.
Nice.
Yeah. So I worked this great engineering job where I got to build satellites and actually fly them in mission control. So I've put 12 satellites into orbit around the Earth. The 13th exploded on launch.
Oh no.
Yeah.
It's a good thing it's not crude.
Yeah.
Is the new way to put it, guys.
Right.
Crude, although it sounds like crude.
Right. Yeah.
It's, yeah. Doesn't really translate that well to audio, but written, it's great.
Totally. Yeah. But I mean, these are still big. Those satellites I worked on are the big ones. They're like the Cadillacs of the satellite industry.
Are they like telecommunications?
Telecommunications, and other. So it's like, you know, I worked on DirecTV satellites, and these are, you know, $300 million satellites. They're super expensive.
But now we have like CubeSats.
We do,
like
which I absolutely love. Yeah,
yeah,
it's so cool. That launch yesterday with SpaceX was just amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
So I worked that, but I had, you know, I love engineering. Engineering is what I always wanted to do, but I always felt that there was like something better you could do with engineering. You could give back with that skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so while I was at Boeing, I actually worked a lot with Engineers Without Borders, which is an amazing organization. They do a lot of clean water and solar power and sanitation projects all over the world. And it's actually where I learned a lot about how to build systems in the right way for those different parts of the world. Because what EWB, Engineers Without Borders, does is they make a long-term commitment with a community. So when you're going to work in a community, you're actually staying there for five plus years.
Mm-hmm.
You're designing systems that can be maintained by that community. You're not flying in fancy, shiny objects from the US or other parts of the world. And all that stuff, it really resonated with me. So I worked with the EWB for a number of years and went back to grad school a couple times. One of those times was at Stanford University. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, still in the engineering school, I ended up somehow getting on a project with the Center for Ocean Solutions, which is based out of Stanford. They're a big ocean think tank. They're trying to think through big ocean issues.
And had you had any like ocean interest or experience prior to that, or was this sort of like out of left field?
Well, I was a scuba diver, so I really, really loved the oceans.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time in them and on boats and stuff, but you know, I didn't know anything about ocean conservation. I didn't know about the issues that the oceans were facing around fishing and all sorts of stuff like that.
By the way, I have to interject simply to say, I don't know how people scuba dive. I don't get it.
Yeah.
It scares the piss out of me. Like on the Nat Geo show, multiple and previous shows that I've worked on, I would get calls from producers like, are you certified? And I'm like, no, nor will I ever be. Is there something just fundamentally in some people that other people are lacking that makes them go like, I want to be underwater?
I don't know. I think so. For me, it was just, you feel you're just in a completely different world. You know, it's just like, I'm in the middle of something that I'm not prepared for, just, you know, physiologically, right? Yeah. Like my body cannot live under here without all this equipment. And even then, it's only just for a short period of time. But I absolutely love the vastness of it. So like if I'm scuba diving in a place where I can't see the bottom, or it's just as far as the eye can see is ocean, and I just absolutely love that.
So you would go to the moon, wouldn't you?
I would go to the moon today if they would take me.
I'm like, hands down, no way, never. Total like death trap. Scuba diving for me, I don't even know if it's about the ocean or the pressure or the fact that you have to use scuba to breathe. I think for me, it's actually the organisms, which is the weirdest thing because I love nature, right? And I love animals and like, you know, I love insects, but there's something about when things are swarming and then they're like, because we're not part of that ecosystem.
Yeah.
So you're hanging out and they're like, what are you? And they just like go around you. Or sometimes they just like swim right into you.
Yeah.
And that is like so scary to me for some reason.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it's amazing. I think it's amazing.
Anyway. Okay. So you start working with this organization.
Yeah. And so what they were looking at was the problem of illegal fishing.
Okay.
Which is this massive problem. You know, it's $23 billion a year industry. It's just this big kind of illegal operation that a lot of really shady people are involved in.
So when you say illegal fishing, like there are laws on the books, depending on the nation where you live, about what you can fish, when you can fish. And that's all based on data about the health of the population.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a perfect world, the way that it's supposed to work is scientists kind of model what these populations look like, and they use information like how many are caught and what size they are when they're caught, what they know about the life history of the animals, all these things that they put into these models, and they try and figure out this is what the population estimate of this is.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like these values that they say, okay, if based off of that population estimate and what the life history of these animals are, that means that we can sustainably catch this number every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that number becomes, whether it be in a country or at the, in the high seas that are these big global treaties that do, that number becomes basically what the quota is, like how many of those fish you can catch.
And so you have to get some sort of permit, and people are checking.
There's a process behind that whole thing, just to manage it, right? And what illegal fishing is it's basically anything outside of that. It's any fishing that's illegal. So it's fishing that's done beyond what the laws are, if it's unregulated. And so if they're fishing in areas where they're not supposed to be fishing, or if it's unreported, those three things kind of become. And unreported is, you know, you're catching things and it's not actually in that quota, right?
Mm.
So we're by definition overfishing, right?
So it's not just like the extreme example is like fishing for sharks and then making shark fin soup. But like, this could be as simple as getting more coho salmon than the government says you can get that year.
Totally. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, we've already seen fish stocks collapse, right? The famous one is the cod collapse that happened off of New England. So, you know, they used to say that the fishery there had so much cod, you could walk on the cod's backs across the water. And that entire fishery, I believe in the 90s, crashed. And this was, you know, thousands of people who only relied on fishing and had absolutely no way to do anything. Like there's no more cod left.
And we kind of see the same thing with salmon, right? One of the most, I think, consumed other than tuna, which is a whole other issue, but one of the most consumed here in North America is like, basically if you're eating Eastern salmon, like Atlantic salmon, it's farmed, right?
Yeah.
Like there is no real.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so there's issues with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had never even known about this. I loved sushi. I would kind of go eat seafood all the time, but I just didn't realize like what impact it was having. And in this project with the Center for Ocean Solutions, I started to see how bad it was, you know, and that really resonated with me. I was like, I want to do something about this, you know, but the Center for Ocean Solutions was made up of you know, conservation biologists and environmental lawyers. That's the only people who are there. So I was this engineer trying to work with them. And I looked at this problem of illegal fishing, and this was back in like 2007, mm-hmm. 2008. And I suggested, hey, you know what? Like, maybe there's some technologies that could help. And so I started talking about all these different types of technologies. I started talking about using drones. And this was back in a time that when you said drones, everyone's thinking about what was happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? It was like it's not something people got for Christmas under their Christmas tree or things like that, right? It was like a big thing.
Totally.
And so they actually loved like all these ideas, and it turned into this independent grad research project that lasted about a year and a half. And then I started working with other NGOs, and that, you know, one thing led to another, and the Nat Geo Explorer thing came along.
That's so cool. So you're basically like your master's thesis at Stanford became in many ways your career.
That's exactly what, yeah.
I love that. Yeah, that doesn't always happen to people.
Yeah, totally.
That's super cool. And so you had done all this work in sort of aerospace engineering, and then you made this, you know, big shift to conservation engineering.
Yeah.
And now you are a conservation technologist, meaning that you make stuff to help conserve or to help improve the survivability, right, of threatened species on our planet.
Yeah, and I mean, not only that, but also a big part of conservation is just understanding what's happening out there. So we have a really bad, we do a really bad job at like just getting that first layer of data.
Yeah, because how are we going to help an organism or a species that's struggling, or a whole ecosystem that's struggling, if we can't even figure out that they are struggling until it's too late?
I mean, if you look at the IUCN Red List, the endangered species list, there's so many species out there that they call data deficient, which basically means we don't know. Like, this species could be on the brink of extinction, but we have no idea because just the data is not there.
And sometimes it seems like things that we thought we knew, like, this happens all the time with science communication, science media. Like, just recently, the New York Times did this massive article about like the insect apocalypse.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, we've known for a while about, let's say, in whose book? Elizabeth Colbert's book, The Sixth Extinction. Sure. She talks about amphibians a lot, right? And we've known for a long time. But then all of a sudden, you're like, oh yeah, and also this one whole portion of the ecosystem is collapsing, and we just kind of found out.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the implications of that, like, we have absolutely no idea, like, what's going to happen. I mean, we're living in this crazy time, right? Because things are changing. We see the impacts of climate change that are happening. There's all these, you know, the report that came out about
I
mean, it's just terrifying.
And then you've got, lack of political will. And it's not just, that's the thing that I think we often forget, is that climate change and pollution and ocean acidification, and like, these are all things that are interrelated, but in many ways are actually like separate issues with completely separate horrific consequences.
Totally,
that come from.
Yeah.
Like, the ocean is becoming more acidic, mostly due to climate change, but that's a whole other thing than the ocean rising or the ocean being warmer.
Right. Yeah. But the thing is, it's all connected to us too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so much of our food comes from these places. Every other breath we take comes from the ocean. It's actually the oxygen that's created in the ocean. And so if reefs collapse and we have like all the, you know, just this massive collapses in the ocean, it's going to have profound implications on humanity.
Oh yeah, we're going to be eating cockroaches and jellyfish.
It's crazy. But like, that's like the hardest thing to get people to actually be, you know, care about.
Well, and isn't that the sad thing too?
It feels huge to them. I think that's part of the reason.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Right?
And where do I even start? And also, is it how can I do something? And we'll get to all of that. But isn't it also sad that like the only way that we can get people to like act and to care is to be like, look how it's going to impact you,
you know, totally.
Not like, oh yeah, but the earth is sick.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, you damn hippie.
Right.
Like, no, but it's like, it can't sustain us when it's this sick. And that's a problem.
The worst part too is, it's all our fault, right?
I know, we did this.
If humans weren't there, the earth would be fine.
Well, and the really messed up part too is that societies like American society, and I say we because, you know, that's where we're recording this podcast, is here in Southern California. Looking at the data from the listeners of my podcast, it sort of goes in order as you would expect because it's an English language podcast. So it's like, first it's the US, then Canada, then Australia, then the UK, and then you start filtering in other European countries. But also there are a lot of African nations, a lot of Middle Eastern nations, East Asian nations that listen to the show.
So I hate to be super like kind of Americocentric. But what's frustrating is that nations like America, where we have the buffer of wealth to not feel these effects, mm-hmm. are the places where the vast majority of this problem are being created.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but we're going to feel it. We're going to have yeah. our own climate refugees in this country.
Totally. It's just so sad that basically the rest of the globe has to be on fire before we do.
Totally.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's... Yeah.
I was listening to the radio yesterday. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember what it was, but they're talking about this issue. And it was a bunch of journalists and scientists all talking together. And the general consensus was, we're not going to do anything about climate change until the fires are just, you know, burning everything down and the floods are coming in and just destroying communities. It's really got to like kick us in the face before we act, which is just such a depressing thing to see.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, we love the treatment, not the prevention, right? Yeah. And yeah, we're going to do something about climate change when we have no other option.
Right.
Yeah. When like we don't have any more fossil fuels, and that's why we have to start using alternative energy. Unless, I don't know, we never know who's going to win in the next election. Because I think there was a lot of hope. That's the thing. So much of this is determined by not just political will, but of course, as you know, the will of society at large. And so when you have leadership and you have legislation, but also kind of public consciousness, like media consciousness, that is trending in a certain direction, you can see massive change get behind that.
Totally. Yeah, you can. And, you know, there's been some fantastic conservation campaigns that mm-hmm. have used that to kind of save species or stop poaching or stop the illegal wildlife trade in certain things like rhino horn and elephants.
Totally.
Ivory, right? And so it's something that actually works. I think inherently people want to do something about it. It's just when you talk about things at that scale, it feels that you can't.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think also part of it is that we're just getting more savvy with social media, social psychology, marketing. So you've got these campaigns that are like cool, like the whole green hippie movement, like tree hugging isn't cool anymore. So you have to sort of approach it in a way that feels like fresh and young and gets people excited. Like I'm actually wearing a hoodie from, you guys remember Beth Pratt? She was on the show years ago. But she's the California head of the National Wildlife Federation. And she did this whole campaign around the LA Cougars and P22 living in Griffith Park. And like, I have a hoodie that says like, P22 is my homeboy. And people in LA love this cat because of the marketing campaign.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and totally. It's brilliant.
Totally.
And that's how it has to be like cool again to like carry your water bottle and I have my reusable straws and my fanny pack. Oh my God, that's so embarrassing. But that's how it is.
Right.
Yeah, we've got to totally. Be that. And it's little things like that, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it totally is. And it's there's a big impact in terms of what you do every day, like the decisions that you make, the things that you eat, the products that you buy, all that stuff matters. And mm-hmm. it really does. And I mean, not to say that it doesn't matter to do more or try and do bigger things, but just those small things does make an impact. Because if everybody did it, then like we're going to change industries and we're going to stop this problem overall.
You know? Completely. If everybody just decided to not buy single-use plastic anymore, there would be no single-use plastic industry. Right. And then we wouldn't have to have the massive problems that we have from that. What are you doing about plastic, Shaw? No, okay. So let's talk about what, like, that brought us to today.
Right.
And, well, to 2015. And since then, you've been working, and you said your space, Conservify, is actually in downtown LA.
Yeah, it's right by the kind of by the Staples Center in downtown LA. And it's just kind of this big, we have a big lab that it is. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool.
And so how many people work there? You know, like, do you employ people? Are they freelance? Yeah. How does this work?
So we have, so right now, mm-hmm. as of today, there's only one other full-time person there. But we're hiring more full-time people in the coming weeks. So we're adding 5 people to the team.
Oh, wow.
And then we have consultants, so experts in some sort of engineering that helps in one way or another that help us with certain projects. And in the past, we were like very much project funded. And so it would ebb and flow in terms of staffing and how we could support that.
Almost like a TV studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just bringing for the new show.
Yeah. But fortunately, now we have some support to think more bigger picture on that, which will help us. But the other thing that we do a lot of, which is actually phenomenal, and it came from my work with Engineers Without Borders, is we work with volunteer engineers that are working on these sorts of things. And so these are individuals that have great engineering knowledge. They want to help out, but they also have a fantastic job that they don't want to leave. You know,
so and it's like some person at SpaceX, who's right? Like, but exactly. Also, I want to go to the stars, but totally. Also, I want to help the oceans.
Yep, yeah, cool. It's exactly those sorts of people, and we've had volunteers that came in to help us develop some specific type of technology. Mm-hmm. We've had ones that actually helped and went and deployed stuff. So we've sent volunteers to Angola or different parts of the world working on some of these things just because they've been so engaged in the projects that we do. And since we're open source, you know, anybody who wants to help can help. We're totally open to that. We have formal mechanisms, and then we have people who just, you know, go and look at our GitHub and like look at the code and stuff and say, oh, maybe you want to change this thing or whatever.
All right, everyone, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank a new sponsor this week, Lola, a modern approach to feminine care. Did you know that the FDA does not require brands to disclose a comprehensive list of ingredients in their feminine care products? So, of course, most of them don't. But Lola's different. They offer complete transparency about everything that's found in their tampons, pads, liners, and wipes. The truth is, most major big box brands that you find at the store put all sorts of stuff into their products, including rayon, polyester. They have, you know, harsh cleansing agents, fragrances, and even added dyes. But Lola products are 100% cotton with nothing added. No fragrances, no synthetics, no dyes. They also make your month easier. It's just easier because it's a subscription program that you can fully customize. You can pick your mix of products, your level of absorbency, the number of boxes, and how often you get them delivered. Because as we all know, every woman is different and our needs are unique month to month. You know, Lola's subscription is super flexible. You can change, you can skip, or you can cancel at any time. My favorite part, Lola was founded by women for women. So, of course, this does not happen enough. You know, we know what's up. We know what we need. And it's so great to hear that this company really comes from that place of insider knowledge. They offer a full product line, pads, liners, plastic applicator tampons that are BPA-free, but also, you know, more environmentally conscientious non-applicator tampons. And they now offer cleansing wipes. They're the first biodegradable wipe of their kind. They're individually packaged. They're perfect for on the go. They're gynecologist approved and hypoallergenic. And one more cool thing, for every purchase, Lola donates feminine care products to homeless shelters across the U.S. So what are you waiting for? I'm a big fan of Lola. I've tried it. I loved how convenient it is. I love that, you know, I know what's going on in around my body. And I know that you're going to love it too. So guys, for 40% off all subscriptions, just visit mylola.com and enter the promo code NERDY when you subscribe. Again, that's mylola.com and enter the promo code NERDY. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So there's got to be, and tell me if I'm wrong here, like, okay, you are a nonprofit organization, which means that there's certain like laws about how you run your business, about how you, you know, maintain your money and how you give payouts to individuals who work there. But this is what you do for a living. You're a full-time employee. So you make enough money not to starve to death working there. But everything's open source, which means from a financial perspective, you heavily rely on funding, like grant funding. You have to fundraise. Is there ever been a part of you that has this capitalist pull that's like, oh, if we only got a patent for this, or if only we could sell this, like we could fund so much more? Or is that just fundamentally A, improbable, and B, against the ethos of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, as a nonprofit, you could sell things. You just have to structure it in the right sort of way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of our work, we're developing this thing called FieldKit, which we could talk about a little bit later. And some of FieldKit is going to be sold, so mm-hmm. people can buy it. That's going to help fund us.
And that
us.
Helps make you money.
Yeah, but we are funded by foundations primarily. So National Geographic, Moore Foundation, Schmidt Foundation, people like that. And they support the work that we do through that. Conservify has a mission, and part of its mission is that we want to spread this knowledge, right? We want conservation technology to become a more accessible thing to people out there. We want these kinds of tech approaches to be used all over the world. And I know that I'm not going to have the capacity to deploy them all over the world. I don't even want that. I want people in other parts of the world deploying it for themselves and understanding how these things kind of come together. Just so the better we can get at this just more broadly, the better we're going to be at conservation, right? It's not, I mean, I don't have any kind of a selfish desire when it comes to that sort of stuff, just because I see the state of the world as it is, and I want to help as much as I can. And I know the only really, the best way to scale that impact is just by other people doing it, right? It's so, just not going to be me.
Yeah. The purpose of ConservaFi is not to make money. You have to make money in an effort to be able to keep doing what you're doing. That's,
right.
That's really what that's about.
Yeah. I mean, the purpose of ConservaFi is to kind of test out some of these new technologies and develop around these new innovations and see if they work. And if it works, then we put it out in the world and let other people take it.
So that's one thing that, like, you've mentioned a few times that we haven't really, you know, done a deep dive into, is that, you know, your shop is in DTLA. You live here in Los Angeles, but you also basically live all over the world because these projects are centered anywhere you can think of.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've been fortunate to work all over Africa and South America. We have projects right now. We have active projects in, you know, Banff up in Canada. We're doing stuff across the entire Amazon rainforest. We did a lot of work for a number of years in Botswana, Angola, Namibia. Right now we're working in Congo and Cameroon as well. And then this next year we have projects in Sri Lanka, Antarctica. My goal is by the end of 2019 that we will have deployed ConservaFi developed tech on every continent and in every ocean. And we're pretty close to being there.
That's incredible. And so that must be kind of expensive, just getting to these places, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not only expensive, but it takes a lot of time. So, you know, like, I went to Cameroon. We have a project with UCLA there. And we're going to this rainforest reserve that's kind of in the southeastern part of Cameroon. And, you know, I was on the ground for 3 days, in the field for 3 days, doing some assessments and stuff for some of the tech that we're going to take there. But the entire trip took me 13 days because, you know, flying there, and then we had to drive like a long way to get there. And then the hike was 30 miles to get into the research camp. And so there's all this stuff, and you have to carry the gear along with you the entire way. And I mean, it's logistics around the travel is a huge part of the stuff that we do.
But of course, the people who work there and live there don't have to travel that much. So
right.
Once this stuff nucleates,
yeah.
You know, you have this site and it starts to web out, and individuals can sort of take it, make it their own, and continue the mission and continue the work. That's a sort of early investment that amortizes really well.
Yeah. And every project that we have, we work with a partner that knows the science and has deep roots in that community, with local people, working with local scientists, building local programs. All that stuff is critically important to the work that we do. And the tech that we develop is meant to enable that work, right? It's meant to help gather data in ways that they weren't able to gather before, or be low cost enough that instead of deploying two of them, they can now deploy 200 of them and start to understand these changes to the ecosystem or critical data that we're missing in terms of these major conservation issues.
I can just hear people listening to the show right now being like, stop beating around the bush and just talk about the fucking tech, which is something I haven't directly asked you about yet at all. So yeah. I really want to spend the rest of the time talking about what these projects actually are.
Yeah.
We're talking around them a lot. What are they? Like, let's start with Cameroon, for example. What are you doing? What was this project and what is the technology?
Sure. Yeah. So the Cameroon work and the Amazon work, they're actually similar. So I'll go back a little bit to explain where that came from. One is, we've seen this incredible explosion in these low costs and these small computing devices. A lot of it came from what they call embedded devices that are basically microcontrollers and things like Arduinos and Raspberry Pis. If you ever heard about those, as like mini computers and microcontrollers that people use to hack and do interesting stuff. So there was this massive explosion in that sort of stuff over the last 10 years. And the ability and the cost of that really got driven low. And so some of the research that I was doing in 2013 and 2014 was around how you can use these low-cost devices to actually do environmental monitoring. Mm-hmm. And that became part of a project that was called Into the Okavango. That's actually a major National Geographic initiative right now. So what happened was there was a scientist named Steve Boyes who was doing a biodiversity assessment in the Okavango Delta year after year. But he was doing it the way that many scientists did in the past, where they would travel through the area and use a notepad and a pencil, and they would write down the sightings of animals that they saw.
Yeah.
And so we had this idea in 2013 where we could take his expedition, the one that he's going on year after year, but we can modernize it with technology. Mm-hmm. So how do we take that kind of embedded devices and apps and all the stuff that we know how to do and change the way that you do an expedition? And what we did was we created all these tools around it, where we turned this Into the Okavango expedition into a live data expedition, where everything that was collected, water quality data, weather information, images, sounds, even the observations, was just collected and beamed up live via satellite. And we brought it back. And then Jer Thorpe and his team created this beautiful website called IntoTheOkavango.org.
Whoa. So it's like iNaturalist on steroids.
Yeah. I mean, it's just what, you know, the great thing about it was, you know, while we were on expedition, when we were in the middle of Botswana, you could go to the website and you could see where we're at. You could see what kind of sightings we had, the images, the sounds. You can even see our heartbeats at that location.
Oh, wow. And the cool thing is, too, that ultimately you can have locals doing the same thing. And of course, they're better at sightings than you are.
Exactly. So yeah. The idea was we were doing this year after year, and we had this massive kind of interest from mm-hmm. people in following the expedition, wanting to know to see the kinds of things we do. Like, just to explain how massive our interest was, in 2015, there was a part of the expedition, 2015? Yeah, 2015, there was a part of the expedition when we were in Angola, mm-hmm. and, you know, the rivers were really thin and windy and moving fast. The boats kept on capsizing, and it was this really, really horrible part of the expedition. There's bees everywhere, ugh. And fires had burned most of that landscape, and there's landmines, so you couldn't really stray off very far. So it was like pretty intense part of the expedition, and kind of in the interest of sharing everything with everyone through this live data thing, we complained about it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we had built a pretty good Twitter following, a pretty good Instagram following. And one of the people who was following our expedition tweeted us back this message of support. And that person was actually Samantha Cristoforetti, who's a European Space Agency astronaut that was on the International Space Station at the time.
That's awesome.
And took a picture from the ISS of the Delta and tweeted it down to us.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had this project that had this massive reach, mm-hmm. you know, reach that went beyond the Earth, right? this great reach. And the impact was great. But like, I had so many people contacting me saying, I want to be able to do the same thing. Like, why can I not do this? And it took us so much development to get there. And we made a bunch of mistakes and failed a bunch and all this stuff. And so we had this idea, let's create something that allows anybody to do this sort of thing. And so that is where our project called FieldKit was born out of. It's like, let's create these low-cost sensors, let's create an app, let's create a beautiful visualization website that allows anybody to do this sort of thing.
So it really collects kind of all, and we're talking about that early stage of monitoring, of gathering data.
Yeah. And then also how you could take the data and tell a story with it, because mm-hmm. you could tell a story from some of this data in some interesting sort of ways. Part of the problem with that space of this low cost sensing was that the variation in quality and cost of these sensors is just, it's huge. And so part of what FieldKit's purpose and mission is to create this open source library of different types of sensors. So mm-hmm. anybody who wants to go measure water quality or air quality or soil moisture or sound level and all sorts of things, they have these sensors. They can go and they can either buy them if they want, or they can learn about how they're made and make them themselves in their backyard or whatever. So the idea is to level this entire playing field.
And it helps standardize so that when people do publish, or at least they want to share this information, they can say, oh, this one is not as sensitive. So, totally. You know, we need to calibrate it differently or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And capture all that information, because there's people who are doing projects here and there about this sort of stuff. But if you go and read their documentation online and blog, or wherever, I mean, everyone's making the same mistakes.
Isn't it so frustrating how much in science we just keep reinventing the wheel all the time? Because nobody publishes failures, only publish successes, and they always want to be like, open source is not very like hip in the science community. So people want to be like, oh, I did it my way that I'm not going to tell you how, because then you're going to scoop me.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, it seems like the new generation of scientists are getting a little bit better when it comes to that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, all that's incredibly frustrating. The methods, opening all that and opening the data also, like the fact that people overprotect things in the academic space is just incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, like they're supposed to share data, but usually you literally have to call them on the phone and be like, can I like see your actual data set? And then they're like, oh, it's all handwritten and we lost some of it. But yeah, this is what we have so far. And it's,
and if it's federally funded, I mean, it belongs to us.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So the idea was, let's create FieldKit. It's this free and open source tool. We'll sell different kits for the sensors if people want to buy them, or they can build their own, whatever happens. And we've been developing it over the last, year or so, right? And right now we're funded by the Moore Foundation to kind of take it to public release. So next year, it's going to be available to anybody who wants to use. But during this development process, we have partners that we're working on in implementations. One of those is around in Cameroon, in the Jaw Reserve. So UCLA has this organization that they're a part of. I think they started called the Congo Basin Institute.
Okay.
And it's around studying the Congo Basin, the rainforest in that region. And their first kind of flagship research camp is in the Jaw Reserve. And so we're putting sensors all over that entire reserve, weather sensors, camera traps, all sorts of stuff that people want for that data. We're working with the researchers there to do that and then bring that data back live. The bigger project that we have around FieldKit right now is one that we're doing with the Wildlife Conservation Society across the entire Amazon basin. So it's actually going to be implemented in 5 of the 7 countries that make up the Amazon rainforest.
Wow.
And that project is deeply, deeply rooted in indigenous people. It's called it's a citizen science for the Amazon project.
Mm-hmm.
And what the main goals are is to understand how the Amazon basin is changing. And so one of the ways they're doing that is with migratory fishes. And so they're trying to track migratory fishes through, because as they add dams in the Amazon basin, it's removing this connectivity for these fishes. And, the longest freshwater migration in the world happens in the Amazon.
Yeah.
And so they're really interested in this sort of thing and how that impacts these indigenous communities all across the way that have lived off of these fish as their, one of their major food sources for generations, right? And then we're bringing in the tech to understand how water quality and weather and some of the other parameters, flow levels and flood levels, like how we could use sensors to measure that stuff, but sensors that belong to those indigenous communities that we're working with. So we've been just deploying. A week and a half ago, we sent 18 sensors that are going down into the Brazilian Amazon. And we're right now building, 35 more that are going to go into Colombia and some other places.
That's so cool. It kind of reminds me of a few weeks ago on the show, I interviewed George David Haskell, one of the two, Dr. Haskell. And he writes a lot about conservation. He writes a lot about connectivity and sort of nature, humanity, the interplay. And he really warned a lot this sort of, I think, old colonialist view that like nature's somehow outside of us. And that we are like, well, there's like the stuff that humans do. And then there's like the pristine, untouched nature. And we talked a lot on the show about earlier, I had somebody on named Joe Ruxton, who's a producer on Blue Planet, but ultimately ended up EPing a plastic ocean to sort of tell what she saw as like the more true story of what the ocean actually looks like. Because you have these aspirational shots from Blue Planet, but she's like, hey, come on, you're panning, garbage. Like, you don't see those pristine shots. So she felt, a moral obligation to tell that side of the story. Anyway, the reason I bring all this up is because my concern is that there are people listening right now that are hearing talk about putting sensors and camera traps and technology and satellites and, wiring and all this stuff into these places that they think of as being pristine, untouched, ecosystem and how should, you know, where do we get off going in and putting technology in places where technology doesn't belong? And so I'm interested in your kind of answer, your take on a question like that, because I'm sure you sometimes get that kind of
pushback. I get it all the time. And, you know, there are issues around technology just generally, right? Where the minerals and metals and all the stuff that we use come from that make up this technology, the plastics that we have to use for all this sort of stuff. So yes, there's inherent issues around technology from an environmental standpoint. But I think what we're trying to do with this sort of tech is just stop the hemorrhaging when it comes to environmental, like how we protect the environment. Right now, these pristine environments in some parts of these places, they're just sitting there and they're being logged. You know, people are hunting everything out of these ecosystems. All this stuff's happening because there's no way to monitor it. There's no way to understand it, right? And so, you know, what you say about this kind of artificial idea of these pristine habitats is entirely true, right? A lot of these places are no longer pristine. Mm-hmm. A lot of these places, you can't find the animals that were iconic and made it famous in the first place. They're just not there anymore.
And there's nowhere in the world that people aren't. And people have been affecting the landscape for literally hundreds of thousands of years.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's where we're at, right? And we're at a place that we really need to understand how these sorts of things are changing. And we need to put in mechanisms that can stop the folks that are trying to exploit those places. Because there's, you know, it's just when it comes down to some parts of this world, it just, you have to, the people who live there have to do something just to make sure that they can get a meal, right? And if that means tipping off a poacher, or if that means helping an illegal logging operation, for those people, that's life or death. That's a life or death decision. You know, so it's very easy for someone here in their comfortable house in the U.S. living in a place where the ecosystem's already been changed, right? Suburbia or something like that. To say those people need to stop helping.
Oh yeah, to vilify.
Poachers, right, to vilify them, right?
That's when we've got palm oil in like every single ingredient in our kitchens. Totally. And
But the reason why that stuff happens is because there's no other mechanisms for those people to do anything to gain any sort of a real resource, you know. But if we can build programs where maybe they can use technology to gather data, and that data is used for a bigger purpose, or you know, if there's something else there, some other opportunity, and then maybe if we can also understand what that current state of that area is and put in systems to monitor it real time, then we can start to slow that change, right? We can start to protect some of these areas and allow species to come back into them and them to get back to a point where, I mean, they're never going to be in their prime, right? Because humans have changed this planet forever. Mm-hmm. But get to a point where species are protected and they can thrive and evolve alongside.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm often sort of haunted by this very, I don't know if I want to say very American. I actually think in this case, maybe very human, but probably much more Western mentality of like, let's do the thing we want to do right now, because right now we will feel the effects of it, instead of thinking about how it's going to affect things downstream. So like the example that I usually use when we talk about this like short-sighted mentality is satellites and now the problem of space junk, right? This idea of like, well, we'll put a thing up there because it solves a lot of problems, but we won't have any conversation about how we're going to take it back down or what we're going to do with it when its life expires. But at the same time, isn't it the technologists, the actual engineers working on these problems who are best primed to be thinking about, you know, using more sustainable tools or resources when they build these technologies or ways that these technologies can be taken back out of the landscape?
Yeah, I mean, what I call it when I'm thinking about this, it's all part of the design process. And I say, whatever we're putting out there, it's got to, I call it failing gracefully. So it's got to fail in a way that it's not catastrophic, right? Yeah. It's not damaging what we are trying to study. And it's a way that's like easily removed and you could take it out and it's pristine afterwards. And so that's the idea, is that everything that we create fails gracefully. And, you know, I mean, we're trying stuff, new stuff, we're trying innovation around this thing. So we fail a lot. Failing is all a part of the job. And so, you know, we always think very deeply about our impact on these areas.
Yeah, I'm always thinking in terms of metaphor. Like, you wouldn't want, for example, a tracking collar on a large like a charismatic kind of megafauna to like, you know, strangle it and kill it. Like, you don't want that. That's bad. But you also, you know, I'm thinking of, like, you mentioned stopping the hemorrhaging, and then I had an immediate image of somebody with a horrible gash in their arm needing stitches. And back in the day, you would have to put in stitches that then you'd have to come back to get them taken out. Mm-hmm. Now we have really cool things where the stitches dissolve and they, you know, are absorbed back into your body. But that takes iteration, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. We're learning every time. I mean, every new piece of tech we put out is better in, you know, 15 different ways than it was the last one, right? It's all a process of kind of evolving and getting better
as you're doing it. I think it's also interesting that you mentioned smartphones, because it's one of those pieces of tech that I think we often, it's a bit of a black box. Nobody really knows how they work. That's not true, but most people who use them don't know how they work. And, you know, we always joke that, like, we have more computing power in our hands than you know, sent the first astronauts to the moon and blah, blah, blah. But it's become kind of cliche. Like, people don't actually think about what that means.
Yeah.
And there are places in the world that don't have access to clean water, that don't have viable options for employment, yet people have cell phones.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, they're everywhere. It's crazy. And that's part of what's enabled this whole area to come out, right? Is creating these sorts of things. I think, you know, me personally, I think we try and replace that technology too often in kind of more, I guess, wealthy societies, you know, where we need that new smartphone year after year. And that's like kind of a necessity, like not necessary, right? Because we're really, those smartphones have an impact as well, right? I mean, there's mining operations that are happening in parts of this world that are humanitarian issues, environmental issues, and all that stuff. And it is fueled by that smartphone industry. That's the dark side that everybody really needs to talk about to understand this does actually have an impact. And I think also, you know, just broadly with the lower cost of technologies, we've turned into much worse of a throwaway culture than we ever were before, right? There's actually this movement that happens in the, I would say maybe it's like the hacker area, you know, makers, like this right to repair movement that I think is fantastic. You know, it's these people that want to be able to repair the devices that they have. I was at the Open Hardware Summit, and one of the speakers there was talking about, I believe it was an Austrian engineer that opened up this shop. And it was a repair shop. And in the shop, he said he would repair anything you brought to him. You can bring a computer, an espresso machine, whatever it is. But the one requirement, and you didn't have to pay for it, but the one requirement was that you had to sit next to him and learn how to repair it. And I thought that was amazing.
That's,
you know,
super cool.
Because if we knew how to repair a lot of these things in our houses, we wouldn't just go to Amazon and buy something new. You know, like when something breaks, we would fix it and keep on using it. And I think that's an important thing that we can do here in this part of the world to help with the broader environmental implications around this consumer culture that we live in.
Totally. Or at the very least, and you're right, we need to be empowered to understand how all of our technology works. I mean, when people ask, like, why should I know how my smartphone works? It's like, there are many philosophical reasons that we should know, but also practical ones. Or at least to empower that if my phone does break and it feels like a brick and there's no way I'm ever going to get past this, I know that I can put it in the hands of somebody where it'll have good use, you know, like a young sort of hacker technologist, or like that it can be repurposed in a place where people don't have access to the newest technology. It can be stripped for parts and reused. And I think you're starting to see that more. I've been to a few children's maker spaces where the people who run the maker spaces collect just old stuff. And the kids, even if they can't, you know, reuse all the pieces of this phone to make a functioning phone, they'll like make new stuff out of it, like art.
Yeah.
Which is really fun to see.
And another great example of that is a really good friend of mine whose name is Topher White. He started this organization called Rainforest Connection.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea around it was that you could take these used cell phones that nobody wants anymore, these smartphones. He writes software on them and like connects them to solar panels and puts a microphone in it and then puts it up in the rainforest, and the software actually listens for illegal logging happening.
Oh, cool.
And so it works to the way that, like, you know, if you put a microphone on a smartphone and you write the right software, you can have it pick up the acoustic signature of a chainsaw or a motorcycle in a very loud rainforest in a way that, like, we wouldn't even be able to hear from our ears. And actually, the first time Topher went out to put one of those pieces of tech in the rainforest, they mounted it and then they like turned it on and they found someone who was cutting down a tree illegally, like right around the corner.
Whoa.
And Topher is also a conservation technologist. So, there's fantastic things that you can do with this sort of stuff once it goes outside of its life cycle.
Yeah. And just to think about that and literally Google it. Don't just assume like, I'll put it in the trash. And, you know, it really reminds me of, I'm always like linking back to old episodes of the show that I've done. You guys remember when I interviewed Lori Winkless, who wrote the book Science and the City, and she is now in New Zealand from Ireland. And she writes about like the science of the metropolis, like sewage systems and water purification, all the things that go on to make a city functional. But a big thing, like the biggest takeaway I took from that episode, and I still to this day reference it on a regular basis, is this concept of throwing things away that we've developed as a culture and a society. There is no away.
Right.
All that shit goes somewhere.
Yeah.
And we've got to think about that. When I do the simple act of putting in the trash compactor, I have to say it's probably the worst invention of all time because it really gave you this idea that you're dropping something into a vortex to nowhere.
Yeah.
But you're not.
I mean, and it's crazy. I was on a beach in Ghana, mm-hmm. and we were right outside of the naval university that they have there. And we walked on this beach and there was just so much plastic garbage that, you know, at one point I stepped out onto some of that plastic garbage and my foot sunk 2.5 feet of just bottles. I mean, it was, you couldn't even see the sand underneath it. It was just absolutely incredible to see that sort of waste out there. And all that waste is going out into our oceans. It's just,
oh yeah, and again, it's coming back to us. We're eating fish, and you know, the seabirds, all of that are packed full of plastic, like krill. We're also like, I mean, A Plastic Ocean did such a great job to show these like really devastating vignettes of individuals in these like small Pacific Island communities who have so much trash, don't know what to do with it, and are struggling for basic commodities to live, that they're burning trash for cooking fuel.
Yeah.
And it's like they're literally burning plastic bags and bottles and putting off God knows what kind of carcinogens directly into the air they're breathing.
Yeah.
And then they're eating that food because it's the only way that they know to get rid of it. And it's like a cheap source for them. This is not okay.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the pictures from Midway Atoll, which is, you know, basically the most remote island you can get from most of our landmass. And there's these albatrosses that have just died and you see them open and rotting, and they're just entire insides is just full of plastics and lighters
packed.
And bottle caps and all sorts of stuff. It's just devastating.
It's devastating. I mean, we've found somewhat recently, this was probably within the last 2 years, you remember, trash in the Mariana Trench, literally the most remote place, like beyond the most remote island, the deepest part of the ocean.
Right.
And there's human garbage, plastic waste that found its way all the way down there. I mean, it's, you know, we have to remember this every day, I think, because it'll motivate us to make, because not all of us can be conservation technologists, but we can feed the work that you're doing by making mindful decisions. It's really, it comes down to mindfulness, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It just comes down to thinking about every decision we make instead of just being automatons.
Yeah. I mean, the first time I started to kind of deeply think about that was when I was doing that work at Stanford around illegal fishing. And this was close to the time, I think shortly afterwards, Monterey Bay Aquarium came out with their Seafood Watch program. It's now an app. And it's fantastic.
Scan shit, right?
Yeah. Well, like, and it's got like, it basically uses your location and then all the research behind, you know, if you're eating albacore in Los Angeles, chances are the albacore came from these places. And I know a lot of times you don't know where your seafood comes from. I wish that wasn't the case. I wish everybody knew where their seafood came from. And even when you ask in restaurants, a lot of times they don't know.
Yeah, sometimes they even sell stuff that's not real, like escarole. That's a whole thing.
Right.
Yeah,
mislabeled seafood's a big thing. But Seafood Watch allows you to make better decisions about what you're eating. It tells you definitely don't ever eat Chilean sea bass or orange roughy or these fish that we know are overfished and have these big life histories. And I mean,
tuna.
Yeah, tuna, yeah, exactly. So and like, seriously, just the decision of changing one single meal is something that does not have a big impact in your life, right? It's, you know, 3 months from now, you're not going to remember that you made the decision to eat this versus that, right? But it does have a big impact on that seafood supply chain and the stuff that's coming in.
It really does. And people, I think it's hard for people to make those connections because we're not good at thinking in terms of scale. Like, we evolved to think in the scale that we evolved to think in living on planet Earth with days and months and years. We're not good at thinking about really, really large things or really, really small things or risk benefit analysis, right, or any of that. But the truth is, like, there's a reason that the Meatless Monday campaign really caught on, because like, not eating beef on a Monday, 1/7 your beef intake.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's a big deal. Totally. It means that factory farmers don't have to raise, you know, 1/7 of the amount of cows that they were raising, right, before. And all of those decisions really do aggregate and they add up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. We're talking now. We've moved on to the portion that involves empowerment. I want to know, before we end the show, because I've already kept you for a little over an hour, when we talk about, you know, the decisions that individual people can make. You know, we've been talking about decisions in terms of what we buy, in terms of how we reduce, reuse, or recycle, in terms of consumption, all that good stuff. But as a direct link to the work that you're doing in Conservify, like, what can people do if they're like listening to the show right now and they're like, I want to help this guy. Like, I want to be involved in this somehow.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, we're developing FieldKit as an open source platform. That the work that we've done with drones, all the stuff that we do is open source. So we can always 100% use more help in developing that. And that's not only just like hard engineering knowledge, but it's also things like documentation. That's a big part of open source stuff. So if you just want to write about something, that's like something that we need help on. Graphic design, all of that, anything. We're a small shop. And we're trying to have a huge impact.
Yeah.
And so any help when it comes to any of that, I'm always happy to talk to people about it.
And what if I have no skills? What if like, I'm like, oh, I could beta test or I could like give you money.
Yeah, totally. Both those things definitely help, giving cool money and testing. But also just broadly, you know, we've been talking about how the decisions that you make are important. It's not only the decisions that you make, but it just understanding what that impact is and talking to the people around you also makes a huge impact as well, right? And so, you know, our ability to kind of spread that message nowadays is huge through things like Facebook and Twitter and like just your own network of friends that are in these sorts of things. So if you do learn that maybe I shouldn't eat that orange roughy because it's overfished and it lives a long time and we don't want to eat that anymore, and you tell your friends about it, like, I think that's an important thing to do. You know, when I first learned about what was happening in the oceans, I was literally the last person you wanted to invite to sushi. Yeah. I mean, I was like, maybe you shouldn't eat that because let me explain how that's caught. Or, you know, like, I just learned so much about it. And I was so excited that I was trying to talk to everyone about it. And it did have a big impact. Like, I know people to this day that still don't eat certain things, or they made like big life changes because of a conversation that we had about that, which is huge.
I had an experience like that, which I felt like I was like that annoying girl, but later it came back around that it was actually impactful. So there's a restaurant I like to eat at called Gyukaku, because I'm really into cooking my own Asian meat for some reason. That's like a thing. I eat hot pot all the time, and I eat, this is like yakinaku, I think they call it. So there's a bunch of them around LA, and you go and they give you the meat, it's marinated, and you cook it on the grill top in front of you. And anyway, a regular thing at Gyukaku in Burbank, at least because I don't think the laws have passed the same as they have in LA, is that you would order a water and they would give it to you with a plastic straw in it. And it made me crazy. And so I always carry my own reusable straws. And one guy brought a water out and it had a plastic straw. And I was like, no, because the thing is, if you make the decision for me, I can't put it back in the box.
Right,
you know what I mean? Now, like, it's already been, and I wasn't even empowered to make that decision. And I was being nice to him about it, but he was my waiter, and I'm sure he was like, what the fuck is wrong with this girl? You know, she's so judgy or something. But I came back, he remembered me and didn't give me straw. And I came back another time and the waiter was like, I never put straws in cups anymore unless people ask. And the thing is, my kind of giving him a hard time in a totally nice, playful way actually probably affected tens of thousands of plastic straws from this one waiter.
Totally.
Like, it's amazing. And so sometimes, yes, it's about talking about it. Sometimes it's just about modeling good behavior, you know?
And you know what I've learned too, is I've learned that people are always listening, especially on things like Facebook and stuff. When you're posting things, people are listening. They're not always like that waiter coming back and saying, you know, you told me this and now I, so don't assume that like you're not having an impact, because I've had, I mean, and I'm fairly vocal about what's going on in our political landscape, especially on Facebook. And I've had people who have like messaged me privately saying, I would never write this to you, but I'm listening to what you're saying and I appreciate that. Right.
Yeah.
And that happens with whatever good behavior you're modeling or things that you're talking to. There are people that hear that and that becomes something that sticks in their head, right? Mm-hmm. And that changes their behavior. It's important to be that good model citizen when it comes to these sort of things.
Totally. And there's a social psychology implication from it. You know, I mention a lot of times it's like the worst movie, but also the best movie. The remake of 21 Jump Street. Nobody's seen it, but it was Channing Tatum and what's his name? Oh, shit. Now I'm blanking. The comedian who was really big guy. Now he's kind of skinny and everybody thinks he's not as funny because he's skinny. You know who I'm talking
about, right?
Yes.
Something.
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill.
Good call. And the whole shtick of the movie is that they go back to high school and they like decide to mix up their identities. And so, of course, Channing's supposed to be like the cool guy and Jonah's supposed to be like the nerd, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, back in the 80s or the 70s, whenever the original took place, the guy in the muscle car was like getting all the chicks and stuff. And now it's like the new era. So the guy pulls up in the Prius and all the girls are like, ooh. And the guy in the muscle car, they're like, oh, God, the pollution. You need a smog test because things are changing. And I notice that even in the airport, like something as simple as modeling, walking all the way to the recycle bin, which is a little farther away, and standing there and sorting as you throw things away, the more people see that behavior, we're like lemmings. We just do it too.
Yeah.
Because we're like, oh yeah, that's what you're supposed to do here.
And the other thing we're doing, so part of what we do at ConservFi as well is like, we do a lot of work with kids, like STEM and STEAM stuff around understanding their environment. And also now we have a project with a teacher in Sacramento where we're going to be tracking plastics through the Sacramento Delta.
Oh, cool.
And basically understanding how they go to the ocean. And we're using the same sort of tech that we're using FieldKit to do it, basically. Mm-hmm. And the idea around basically tracking a bottle, a plastic bottle, as it makes its way through the ecosystem and then retrieving it before it goes to the ocean, is for these kids to understand kind of how that stuff moves through. So their decision in their school to drink a soda bottle like has a bigger impact because that soda bottle has a life beyond the 10 minutes it takes for them to drink that, right?
Yeah.
And what I found in doing a lot of the STEM work is that's a huge lever as well, is because these kids, they learn things, they go home, they talk to their parents about it, they yell at their parents for making some of these decisions, and now a household no longer does these sorts of things.
And they're activists at their own school. Like, literally, I could see an entire class of kids at a school being like, we're not buying anything out of this vending machine, so there's no point for it being here unless you replace everything with aluminum cans.
Totally, yeah.
And like, I could see the school being like, God damn it. Yeah. Nobody's bought a Coke in a week. You know, why are we putting money into this? I guess we'll cave, you know? And that's super cool to see.
It is cool.
It's so cool. Oh, I love that. Okay. Well, Shaw, I've kept you for too long. I close every episode the same way, so I'd be remiss if I didn't with you. I always ask my guests at the end of the show to answer two big picture questions. And I'm really interested in your take because of the focused work that you do. So the first one is that I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now. And I want you to tell me, number one, what is the thing that's keeping you up at night? The thing that you're like, maybe even cynical about, maybe like not so, you know, positive, a little pessimistic about. But then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, truthfully, honestly, not playing lip service, optimistic about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think the thing that keeps me up, the thing that I'm like most concerned about is this issue of the sixth mass extinction, right? Mm-hmm. It's this impact, this broader impact that we're having on species and ecosystems that are just outside of what we would consider our daily lives. But it's the choices that we make. It's the things that we buy. It's illegal poaching and wildlife trade that's impacting all that.
Did you see the article recently where they called it the Holocene?
No, I didn't.
God, I know. We've been calling it the Anthropocene for a long time, right? And there's different kind of colloquialisms, but there's like, we're in the Holocene.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I that keeps me up because I go to some, I've been to some of the most incredible parts of this planet, right? I've seen these amazing, pristine environments, and I've seen trash at all of them. I've seen way less animals than I should have seen in those places. I see the impact firsthand.
Yeah.
And the reason why I get kept up at night is because that impact is accelerating and it terrifies me.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm like really trying to work as fast as I can at ConservaFi and help partners. And I mean, I'm just trying to do anything I can do to try and scale that impact so that we can really start to change that equation. So that's what I'm terrified about.
Yeah.
What I'm genuinely, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but what I'm genuinely optimistic about is this change in global consciousness that I see happening, right? So, you know, I remember a time when being an environmentalist was seen as kind of this negative thing, right? It was like, oh, you're this crazy activist, mm-hmm. environmental activist. And it was a lot of like kind of the capitalists and the conservative movement that was really painting the fringe picture on this. And it's not fringe anymore, right? It's just, it's what we have come to expect, right? And I think that is a hugely optimistic and inspiring thing to me. Mm-hmm. Like I want that to be second nature. And I think it'll get there. I'm hopeful that it gets there more quickly than just when everything starts burning down and, you know, and we have to get there.
Yeah.
But, and I do see some movements. Fortunately, I mean, hopefully we start to see globally leaders being brought in that understand the importance of that. And
we were so there before with the Paris Climate Accord.
Yeah, it's depressing. But hopefully
we're talking about the optimistic part now.
Hopefully that changes. And I'm optimistic that it will. I believe people are good at their core.
Yeah.
And that if you give them the right, you give them an opportunity to make the right decision, they'll do that. So I'm very excited about that. I'm also optimistic about the impact that just tech can have in conservation. I think when I first started working there, I had to do a ton of convincing about it. Mm-hmm. And now there's no convincing. Yeah. I mean, the demand is just insane from NGOs and governments to try and implement some of these tools just to get better at what they're doing. And I think that's amazing. I think that's really exciting.
I love it. Well, where can people read more of like what you're doing, follow you on social media, but then also where can they learn more about ConservaFi?
Yeah, so I use Twitter a lot. So I'm at Shaw Selby on Twitter. And then their ConservaFi has a Twitter as well and an Instagram. So you can, if you follow us on that, you can find more information. I think that's probably the most up-to-date stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the process of evolving our website. So maybe by the time this airs, we'll have a new website. So you can go to conservafi.org and check that out.
Good motivation there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Shaw, thank you so much. This has been really illuminating, I think really empowering, and I'm motivated now.
Great. Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.